Donating your old car or truck to NHPR is an easy way to support the news you trust, especially in times like these. We'll arrange to have it picked up safely, running or not, and invest the funds right back into the NHPR programs you love, like Morning Edition, The Exchange, and The Folk Show. Donate that unwanted vehicle today and keep your community informed and connected at nhpr.org/cardonation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. What do graveyards tell us about race, history, and memory? A new video series from NHPR's Civics 101 podcast and the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire explores New Hampshire's Black history through the stories of local grave sites. It uncovers the lives of Black Granite Staters and explores the wide range of their experiences here. The series also challenges stereotypes about New England as the free North. This hour on The Exchange, what these grave sites can teach us about the past here in New Hampshire and around the country. And listeners, let's hear from you. What grave sites have you visited to help you appreciate our history? What did you learn from them? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Gerianne Bogus, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. Gerianne, great to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Laura. It's great to be here with you once again, talking about some of the things that I love, New Hampshire's Black history.
Well, and there's a lot to learn in this video series, which we'll get into for sure. Also with us, Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She's National Director for the Association of Black Women Historians and author of the book Never Caught: The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave. For listeners who don't know, the book is about Ona Judge, who fled to freedom in New Hampshire. And Erica, it's really nice to have you too. Thank you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
And also with us, Gabrielle Forman, Harriet Wilson Scholar, Professor of American Literature and African American Studies and History at Penn State. She's founding director of the Colored Conventions Movement Project, and that is the subject of her forthcoming book as well. And Gabrielle, welcome to you too. Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Well, all of you, Jerry and you first, why do you think this project to preserve these grave sites here in New Hampshire, to understand them, is so important?
It's so funny. When you think of New Hampshire, you never think of Black history because it's not visible. We don't have the memorials. We don't tell it, the stories in our school. So I think this graveyard project is one place where we can start to revisit, reimagine, and look at what New Hampshire's history is when it's more inclusive than we thought. So these stories in this project brings to life these early Black citizens of New Hampshire.
How much do you think, Gerianne, your average Granite Stater knows about these grave sites? In Portsmouth, you have one that's pretty prominent, but what about around the rest of the state, Gerianne?
Oh, very little is known. Only people who really study this, who are genealogists, who are studying, for example, Jane Wiscombe, who is a descendant of one of the people we'll talk about, Samson Battis, who's been doing research. The folks in Warner Historical Society, Lynn and Rebecca, they've been amazing. And there's some other individuals who are really interested in this history that know it, but our average citizen know very little. And when we say anything, it goes, they're really shocked to find out that New Hampshire does indeed have a long, long, long Black history.
Well, Gabrielle, I'll turn to you. What's exciting to you about these efforts here in New Hampshire and elsewhere? You know, what do you think uncovering and learning about these grave sites adds to the conversation, to the understanding about our history?
I think if we pan out to think about early Black grave sites across the United States, then we can see how exceptional the New Hampshire graves of Black citizens are. Grave sites are a place where Black bodies were used for medical experimentation. And this happened across the Northeast. So there were huge riots in the decades after the Revolutionary War when white bodies, particularly poor people, were being resurrected from graveyards to be experimented on in early medical science. And the demonstrators in New York and the doctors' mob, for example, searched private homes, and then they marched to the city jail, and the project swelled to 5,000. There was a standoff with the New York governor and the mayor and the militia. And medical schools and doctors turned to using Black bodies, which again, they dug up from burial grounds to avoid the large riots that occurred when the poor white were the subjects of dissection and anatomical experimentation. So when we really think about the fact that Black graveyards here have survived and been respected, and the efforts of Black communities to make that possible, then we see how exceptional they are. And that seems to me to be a really important context for understanding the larger use of Black bodies in death as well as in life.
Well, that's pretty gruesome, Gabrielle.
It's the beginning of the history of Black medical science in the United States, and it's particularly gruesome for Black communities.
Yeah, and disrespectful when you consider, you know, that most people consider a grave sort of sacred ground. And once the body is buried, in many spiritual traditions, the body should be left to rest.
Black death and Black grave sites haven't been treated as sacred spaces because Black life isn't respected. So when that happens and we under-examine the history of Black exploitation after death, then we see what an appalling feature of white supremacy it really is.
Well, Erica, to you, what do these grave sites tell us about the North in particular and the image that New Englanders have of their role in slavery and abolition?
Yeah, well, first, I actually want to thank Jerry Ann and others who've been so invested and committed to reclaiming the stories, the lives of people who've been unrecognized, in part because these burial grounds have not been marked properly or built over. What's happening in New Hampshire is happening in other places across the nation. And so I live in Philadelphia, and there's a similar project that's happening right now called the Bethel Burial Ground Project. Very similar in that there was a burial ground attached to Mother Bethel AME, which is probably one of the most well-known sort of famous Black churches, AME churches in Philadelphia, in the nation. And at some point over the 19th century, that land was lost, right? The land where people's bodies, babies, women, men, were interred, basically that burial ground was simply sold and built over. A playground was built over that lot. And what's happening in places like Philadelphia and throughout the nation, New Hampshire in particular, is really, I think, a two-pronged attempt at two very important things. One, it's the reclaiming of dignity and markers of life for Black people. And this is extremely important at a moment in time where we have seen in the streets hundreds of thousands of people articulating the importance of Black life, right? So to go back and think about how we mark that life at the end of someone's life in death is important, right? So dignity. But the second part, of course, is we get to the stories of history and to life by looking at death, by reclaiming people, by rewriting a narrative that includes the people who have been forgotten, some for centuries. And so this work really, to me, it tells us something about what's happening in the North. It tells us, it makes us rethink this narrative about Black freedom in the North and abolition, that still throughout the centuries, Black life was undervalued. And now this very important work is going on to reclaim them, to say their names, and to mark them with dignity.
Listeners, we are following up on the work of NHPR Civics 101 Project and the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire about a new video series that explores Black grave sites here in the state. It is newly available today. You can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange to find out more really interesting stories about the Black grave sites here in New Hampshire and what we can learn from them. Right now, we welcome your questions and comments on this. You can send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. So to this project, Jerry-Ann, what are the grave sites that you focused on? Tell us about the range of Black experience here in New Hampshire. You know, you've got people who are businessmen in communities. You've got people who are enslaved. You have a whole range of life experiences here.
The sites that we look at and things that you, sites that you wouldn't think are really related to New Hampshire's Black history, of course, is the one that's really visible right now, the ports, the African burying ground in Portsmouth, which was totally built upon. We talked a lot about that site where we believe there to be over 200 people buried there. We also talked about the Blanchard site in Milford at the town graveyard. And that's interesting because, you know, when we talk about New Hampshire and the burial sites that survive, you know, oftentimes if they do have a marker or a headstone, you know, with a name, we don't know their history. And then we have to go searching for that history. But sometimes where they're buried in the cemetery tells us a lot. For example, Samson Battis site. And just blanking.
In Canterbury, I think, right?
Canterbury, thank you, Jeez. Canterbury, you know, his grave site is really on the kind of outskirt of the cemetery, down a hill in a very isolated spot, woody area near the creek. You know, I think you would think it's one of the most undesirable place in the cemetery for a Revolutionary War veteran to be. But he's there, but he has a headstone with a marker. The other site we look at was the Ona Judd site in Greenland. And that was really, that's a site that tells us a lot about how we honor or do not honor our dead who are people of color. Because we had to walk in the woods to find her site. And I think I went with David Waters and I were in at her site, and snowmobiles tracked had driven all over the grave site, and the headstones once there were all broken. And you know, it's that hidden history. You know, it was such a metaphor for New Hampshire's hidden Black history and how we disappear people from that history.
You know, Samson Battis, Jerry-Ann, I was really interested to learn about him. He was a veterinarian. He bought property. He had a very large family. He's an important citizen who gained his freedom after the Revolutionary War, after he served. How common was that, Jerry-Ann, for Black Revolutionary War soldiers to gain freedom after the war? And what did that mean for them here in New Hampshire?
So I'm not exactly sure how common it is, but we do here in New Hampshire have quite a few formerly enslaved African men who end up here in New Hampshire gaining their freedom after fighting. Samson Battis is only one of them. George Blanchard in Milford, he was a Revolutionary War vet. I'm not sure if he, you know, if he got his freedom after fighting, but also there are just quite a few other African American Revolutionary War veterans in Warner. There is a story there. There is also a graveyard where we know there's some former Revolutionary War vet formerly African men that are there. So for me, this is my own personal thing. I have nothing to prove it, but it was one way of us extending and colonizing the land. You know, this was all native land, and it's a way of getting people out into the wilderness like we did, you know, out west. After their service, they got acres. I know with Samson Battis, he was promised 100 acres of land if he fought in the Revolutionary War for his master. And that's what happened with him.
Erica, what do you know about this Black men's Revolutionary War service and what it means in terms of the historical records that we have of Black Americans and the gravesites? They seems like they were bumped up to prominence once they did that. Prominence isn't the right word, but they gained some measure of independence.
I don't know if I would use the word prominence, but I do right. think that it makes us think about sort of the project of freedom and the hypocrisy attached to the Revolutionary War, a war that supposedly was engaged in and fought because of freedom or for the right to live apart and separate from the British monarch. And, you know, what we see with Black men following the Revolutionary War, and actually not just Black men, but Black women too, is that emancipation or freedom, it's sort of in fits and starts and quite uneven. So there's some who do actually receive their freedom for participating in the Revolutionary War. There are some who are actually promised freedom and don't receive it. But what's important to recognize is that in those years following the revolution, the decade or two after the revolution, there are a whole host of gradual abolition acts that happen from Pennsylvania to Massachusetts throughout New England. And the process of freedom is really sort of, I won't say it's beginning, because we know that people were in the process of taking their freedom or finding freedom in multiple ways before the revolution. But what we see is on the state level that there are laws passed that begin to dismantle the system of slavery. And so that by the time we hit the 1820s or so, we have a generation of people, men who were approaching sort of the later years of their lives, who had participated in the war, and others who had not, who are encountering freedom for the first time. And it really sort of changes the narrative of what New England, of what the Mid-Atlantic looks like by the early years of the early Republic. And so I'd say it's both the revolution and the participation in that, but also the rights that come about due to sort of state laws that loosens the literal shackles of slavery.
Gabrielle, where do we see this echoed elsewhere in our history? You know, where certain Black Americans are recognized and others continue to be, you know, enslaved, buried in mass graves. Where do we see this difference in opportunity that was part of the Black experience?
I think one of the really important things that Dr. Armstrong Dunbar just said is that the history of enslavement is one that is continuous and simultaneous with the history of resistance and freedom. So that Black communities, and we see this in grave records and death records, and sometimes that are connected to grave sites, are communities that are mixed communities in relationship to enslavement and freedom. So that we see this movement toward gradual emancipation that almost overlaps with the antebellum abolitionist movement that begins formally in the 1830s, which is so associated with the South, or freedom movements for the South, the end of slavery in the South. But really, this first wave of emancipation brings us into the late 1820s, when New York and New Jersey are finally evidencing a move toward formally phasing out slavery and enslavement through, right, 1865. So New England is not disassociated. It is connected to the larger movements for Black freedom seekers, both from the African-American communities themselves and from larger movements for social change and social justice that are interracial, so that you have these free Black communities that are coexisting and interconnected. And you see this in probate records, for example, in New England, where Black free people, some of whom have been freed because of their service in the Revolutionary War, which is the most common way to get freedom in New England in that period, are leaving goods and money and objects that they have managed to have as part of their own estate to both free Blacks who are their family and their community, but also to enslaved people in New England itself. So that kind of contiguous and connected community is one of the most important factors of Black community life. And I think it speaks also to the continuing relationship of class and status throughout Jim Crow. When Black communities are living together and those who have achieved education and wealth are also connected to those who have not yet reached that. And that's true for Black wealth distribution today, where those of us who are highly educated and are doing decently economically are still connected and responsible to larger family networks who are not experiencing the kind of wealth that white communities have tenfold over Black communities today.
That's so interesting, Gabrielle. And in terms of your work as a historian, you know, you just said it, those who didn't have status, didn't have wealth, their records are kind of lost, right, Gabrielle? Whereas people who had wealth, had status, like Sampson Battis, we at least have a small sense of who he was and what he did.
And this is why graveyards are so important, right? Because they tell us, as Dr. Armstrong Dunbar said a minute ago, about the children who were lost, whose names otherwise would never be in the historical records or rarely are in the historical records. They tell us about family relationships and grouping and placement, as Jerry M. Bogus just told us. So death records are, for African Americans in the early period, are some of the most important ways that we can remember Black life.
I want to share an email that just came in from a listener, Jay, who says, in relation to your show this Monday, attached is a recent article from the Valley News about our efforts in Lyme to commemorate the graves of two enslaved people who were brought to Lyme, New Hampshire 220 years ago and who died and were buried in a remote cemetery in Lyme. Jay, thank you for that. And we will link that article to our web post for today's show. As always, that's nhpr.org/exchange. Coming up, all of you, a lot more to talk about, including how to tell if a gravesite belongs to a Black American. As Jerry Ann Bogus alluded to, it's not always obvious. You have to look for the clues. We'll find out more. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're following up on the work of NHPR's Civics 101 podcast and the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. They've just launched a new video series today, exploring our state's history through the stories told by Black gravesites. Exchange listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What do you wish you learned about Black history in school? How do you think gravesites might be a valuable tool for teaching future generations? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can give us a call at 800-892-6477. We have three guests for the hour. Jerry Ann Bogus is here, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. Also, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, National Director for the Association of Black Women Historians and author of the book Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave. And also with us, Gabrielle Forman, Professor of American Literature and African American Studies and History at Penn State University. She's founding director of the Colored Conventions Movement Project. That is the subject also of her forthcoming book. Well, all of you, there have been lots of conversations in recent years, as Gerianne said, about, you know, this history right around us, and we don't even know it's there. So, Gerianne, what are some of the clues that you have to look for to tell you that a Black gravesite is indeed a Black gravesite? Sometimes it's not obvious.
That's the thing. There are really no clues to tell us if that person who is buried at a site, unless it's stated on their gravestone, if you know that they're people of color. The research is really done through looking at old records, old stories, old history books. The way we found, the way I found Blanchard's grave in Milford was through the records of the DAR when I knew who I was looking for. The Daughters of the American Revolution had put together a book of, you know, all former Revolutionary War vets where they were buried, you know, and what the sites were. What we did find, and David Waters, a professor at UNH, who's actually now a senator who studies grave sites, is also a big help. And once you have the information where to look in the grave site, it's usually on the outskirts of a grave site in a undesirable spot, like where Samson Battis is, some covered over and buried and disappeared, like the African Burying Ground in Portsmouth, or the one in Warner. It really is trying to recreate and re-piece, put together these bits of history to tell us who they are. One of the projects we're looking at right now, it's just really something simple. In Dover, a late 1700s singer, Nellie Brown, is buried there. She was a famous Black soprano singer in her day. And she's buried right next to her husband, and her husband has his name on the gravesite, but on her headstone, but she doesn't have her name. So this is one way that we'll, you know, try to get her, we will work to get her name on her headstone. Again, bringing that story to life. So other people will come in and say, oh, this is Nellie Brown. Once they know her story, they'll know where she's buried. So it really is piecing this history together. We're re-piecing Black history in the state.
Well, and again, in the video series that is just out today, Gerianne, you and David Waters go to these different sites, you look for the clues, you talk about the documents that sometimes you had to use to sort of back up what you thought you were seeing. How does the history of these grave sites, Gerianne, model the Black experience in our state?
Finding it, right? Going to the places to try to find this history. I think for me, what this project does, it's give us a starting point to really start talking about race in our country. If we go to a site where Black African-Americans have been disappeared from and purposely done, and we've recovered that site, we're also recovering that conversation. So we can start talking in our classes, we can have the conversation, why were they disappeared? Why was it disrespected? Why? You know, and start at a level that we can understand when we talk about race and get into the history of racism and the difficulty, the erasure of this history in our state. It is a starting point. And also, I think it's also a fun project, you know, in this kind of excavating the landscape for the stories. And if we start with our kids from K through 12, you know, engaging them in this history in an imaginative, fun way, we have a way to really bring those stories back to life and re-engage people in this dialogue.
So Erica, as an example of what Gerianne's talking about, tell us about the Ona Judge gravesite. And just quickly, for listeners who might not know who she was, and I know you wrote a whole book about that, we had you on The Exchange, but just briefly remind listeners, please, who Ona Judge was, and then how her gravesite kind of reflects what Gerianne just said.
Yeah, happy to do that. Ona Judge, most folks, I think, at least in Portsmouth, have probably heard of her by now. in part because she's probably one of the most well-known fugitives, or at least someone living, attempting to live outside of the vice grip of slavery in New England. She was the property of Martha and George Washington. And she was brought to Philadelphia, New York, and then Philadelphia as a teenager to serve the Washingtons, Martha in particular. And in 1796, she made the decision after she found out that she was going to be given away as a wedding gift to escape. And she leaves the Washingtons while they're literally eating their supper in May of 1796. And she escapes through with the help of a free Black community in Philadelphia and finds her way to Portsmouth. And the book, Never Caught, traces her life. It does a couple of things. One, it showcases the experiences of Ona Judge as this sort of compelling person who was courageous and had the grit and the tenacity to outwit the most, probably the most powerful couple in the nation. And she did so in New Hampshire. But I think the other thing that it does is it reminds us that we need to step back and think about the founding of the nation, the stories that were happening, the literal building of this nation, and to do it through the eyes of the enslaved. So Ona helps us do that. It's not simply a story about George and Martha Washington or cherry trees or wooden teeth, that this becomes a story about those who the Washingtons enslaved in particular and their fight for freedom. Now Ona, of course, because she was living a hidden life for nearly half a century, she was someone who did not want to be found. So she didn't leave many records. She left two interviews at the end of her life, thank goodness, so that we have her voice. But she, like many other, countless other Black New Englanders, are basically located in an unmarked grave and on private property that Jerry Ann just sort of talked about. When she went to visit her final resting place, I was given permission to do that as well on private property. And, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, there's no marker of her existence on the land in which she lived and died, it's part of a larger narrative and a part of a larger issue that it really sort of erases the history of slavery in New England, right? And this is, in some ways, convenient in terms of the way we think about New England and or New Hampshire in particular and slavery. It's, oh, that was the free North. Oh, they didn't have enslaved people, when indeed, of course, they did. So as Jerry Ann mentioned, the kind of disappearing of these folks, whether intentional or not, it does a disservice to the real narrative about American history in New England. So whether we uncover and mark Ona Judge Staines's final resting place, or the other projects that are burial sites that Jerry Ann's talking about, we must do it in order to correct the narrative about slavery and freedom in New England.
And in the video series, as you know, Erica, you know, you see Jerry Ann and David Waters kind of bushwhacking, you know, to find this very important grave site. What would be an appropriate way, Erica, what do you think, to honor this, either this spot or Ona Judge herself, you know, a grave site elsewhere, a memorial elsewhere, a better grave site on that actual site, which is kind of out in the woods in Greenland?
What
would be ideal?
It's a tricky question and tricky situation, in part because this is private property. We have to remember that this isn't a municipal space. And as you just said, you've got to kind of walk through the woods to get through to the marshy area where her remains and others exist today. You know, and I don't think that we have to, it's not an either or, it's more, you know, I think there can be multiple spaces where we commemorate the life of Ona Judge. Clearly, to have something on the space where she actually is interred is important. I understand the difficulties that can come with that because it's private property, but I'm hoping that over time, that becomes a reality, right? That there, we can create a trail, an appropriate trail, so we're not sort of bushwhacking to get to that spot, and have these sort of markers of dignity for her to commemorate her life. After all, she managed to do what very few other people had done. She actually beat the president. She was never caught. And so we do have to, I think, remember that. But in addition to marking that spot, I think it's important that we commemorate and memorialize her existence in other spaces. You know, she didn't only live or stay in Greenland. We know that she spent significant time in Portsmouth. And the same is true actually in Philadelphia, because her story, at least her escape story, begins in Philadelphia. And one of the things that's happened that the National Park Service has done in Philadelphia is erect a wall with the names of the enslaved who lived forcibly with the Washingtons as he served as president, first president of the United States. And if you go a stone's throw from the actual Liberty Bell, her name is engraved on a wall. There are teleprompters that have sort of reenactors who tell her life story. And I'd really hope to see that sort of replicated throughout Portsmouth and other places.
Well, so through this one story of this incredibly brave young woman, I hear what you're saying, Erica. Just this whole story is revealed. And Gabrielle, it reminds me of your work studying Harriet Wilson, who also has roots in New Hampshire. So just briefly remind our listeners, Gabrielle, who she is. Again, some may know, some may not. And the story of her gravesite.
Harriet Wilson is known in New Hampshire through the Harriet Wilson Project, which Jerry-Ann is one of the founders of, through the sculpture that memorializes her, which I'm sure Jerry-Ann can speak about in a minute, by Fern Cunningham, that really resurrected the life of Harriet Wilson in New Hampshire. And she is the author of a book called Our Nig, which tells the story of the family which held her in bondage and called her their nig, a Black woman who was abandoned by her white mother at the family of a white family in Milford, who were connected through marriage to the most famous abolitionist family in town, the Hutchinson family Singers, and nonetheless kept a young Black child in their home from the time she was six through her adulthood, and so abused her that her health was really compromised and she ended up in a poorhouse. This didn't, however, define her life. She went on to write this important book, which is now taught in classrooms across the country. And she became a major hair care entrepreneur 50 years before Madam C.J. Walker, and then became one of the most important religious speakers in a religious movement that was extraordinarily popular in the late 19th century. She died in 1900, I found out with the help of my partner, Reginald Pitts, and we were the first to pay our respects, we believe, at her gravesite in Quincy, Massachusetts, where she had moved in probably 100 years. Now, her gravesite was marked because she's buried with the white family that she served at the end of her life, both kind of as a peer in the spiritualist movement, which was the religious movement that she was connected to, but also as a servant. So we see the ways in which Black success, an author, an entrepreneur of hair care products, a speaker whose name appears in Black in newspapers and religious newspapers throughout New England over decades, can be reduced to poverty at the end of her life and be dependent on the white family that she had served. Again, that connection to whiteness is why her name is prominently displayed with theirs on a large granite gravestone in a graveyard in Quincy, Massachusetts.
Oh, that's interesting.
But she lived most of her life, much of her life and all of her early life in New Hampshire.
Yeah, and I've seen the statue in Milford, and it's beautiful. And Jerry Ann and I have talked about, you know, that whole project and how it came to be. So Gabrielle, the actual burial site though, the grave site, despite all she did, she doesn't get her own stone. She's there with the family she served.
Yes, and this is, you know, both why it survives, and a testament to what the proximity to wealth and white wealth can bring you. Because as Jerry-Ann and Erica have just talked about, is Black women's headstones in early America, even more than any others, but in addition to Black men, are so very rarely preserved. And unmarked graves, right, are the legacy, not only of the early women we're talking about, but of women like Zora Neale Hurston, one of the most important authors, right, who a gravestone was put on her burial site by Alice Walker. So in the 1970s, right? So we see this kind of precariousness of Black women's lives and the ways in which our history can be literally bulldozed over. And I use that word because of the fact that so many Black burial sites, which were the first thing that Black communities did in mutual aid societies, was raise money to bury their own dead. And those burial sites in place after place after place are subject to the whims of development companies who buy the land and bulldoze over that land, sometimes moving those grave sites to what is now private property, as is the most important Baltimore grave site of Black people. They moved some of the graves and some of the bodies out into the marshes where you have to, right, like figure out how to get there in the ways that Jerry-Ann and Erica were just discussing. And so we have so little of that history preserved.
Well, we have to take a short break, but when we come back, Jerry-Ann, I have lots of emails from listeners who have specific questions about specific sites around New Hampshire. You can keep sending your questions in by email. It's exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 800-892-6477. We'll also talk about using Black grave sites as a tool for educators. All that's coming up. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're following up on the work of NHPR's Civics 101 podcast and the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. They've launched a new video series today exploring our state's history through the stories of Black grave sites. And listeners, let's hear from you. What do you wish you learned about Black history when you were in school? How do you see Black grave sites as a tool to help teach future generations? Once again, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. And Jerry-Ann Bogus, a couple emails I'd like to share with you. Dan in Chester says, first, I've lived in New Hampshire for 25 years and had no idea that Black people were enslaved in our state. I'm sure that I read about enslaved people elsewhere in the North, but it never really registered. Dan says, I lived in Portsmouth when the African burying ground was rediscovered and didn't think much about it at the time. Then I began to think about the other white cemeteries in downtown Portsmouth that are preserved and honored, considered sacred historical sites, and the comparison just emphasizes the disrespect of Black lives. Dan, thank you for writing. And Jerry-Ann, again, you and I have talked about the Portsmouth site before, but many people are not familiar with that site. It is highlighted in this new video series, so folks can check it out there. But just remind us how important this was to uncover this site and honor it as much as you could, given that it had been literally, you know, paved over.
So we really owe Valerie Cunningham a lot of respect for the work that she's done in really raising attention for that burial site in Portsmouth. And I really applaud the citizens of Portsmouth for really standing up and getting this memorial built and supported. Back in 2000, when Valerie first started the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail, she had found a document that talked about this Black segregated burial site. And she had placed a marker on a building designated the area on Church Street as that area that was on the 1700s map. Back in 2000, this is going to be a really abbreviated history of the site. In 2002, during some regular construction of the Court Street because of a sewage pipe leak, when they were doing the backhoe, when they were doing this repair work, the backhoe hits some burials.
And it was stunning, Jerrianne, right? I mean, it was shocking for a lot of people.
Very shocking. But it wasn't the first time the ground was disturbed. You know, there are lots of references in the 1800s, in the papers during the 1800s that talked about, you know, digging up bones in that area.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So the town knew. Historical documents shows that, you know, you can't rebuild over a whole cemetery without disturbing bones, right? So, but they were, because the town knew that this was probably sensitive area, and if anything happens, there were protocols set in place if they should disturb the sites. So they unearthed these coffins that they disturbed. They were DNA tested. And indeed, they were the markers of Africans. And in 2010, after a citywide project to find an artist, they erected the African Burying Ground Memorial in a ceremony. So we now have that testament, that visible testament to the story of enslavement in our state.
And I encourage people to watch again the videos that you made, Jerrianne, in conjunction with Civics 101, because it shows what it looks like, and you get more into the story, and you see some of the newspaper articles at the time and so forth. And I really appreciate Dan writing in on that. A couple more emails that I want to throw at you. And Grace writes, please ask Jerrianne about how churches kept, and using Grace's words here, de-raced the identities of Black families in towns like Hancock, New Hampshire. I attended a walking tour hosted by Black Heritage Trail, New Hampshire, and the Nature Conservancy, which was fascinating and sadly horrifying. So, Jerrianne, I want to ask you about that, but maybe our other guests too, how sometimes people's identities are, again, as Grace says it, de-raced. So go ahead, Jerrianne, you first, please.
Oh, that's so interesting. First of all, the church was really complicit in all of this story and enslavement. You know, the building that we have in Milford, the reverend, as part of his fees, where it was given to enslaved people. And we see that all across the state where, you know, the pastor had their own enslaved people. And we know that as far as segregation goes, we were segregated in church. So here we're preaching this language of Christianity, but Blacks had to sit up in the balcony if the church had an upstairs, or in the back pews, you know, of the church. And then we had to change their religion, Christianize them, in order to bring them in the fold, so to speak, but yet still keeping them segregated. So we have a long history of Christianity at one point following this theme of segregation, yet including them in with the Bible to further enslave their bodies and minds.
So Erica, as historians, you know, here we have church records, other town records, and as Grace alludes, sometimes those records try to either not mention the racial identity of the person or change it, as she points out. Have you found this, Erica, in your research?
Yeah, well, I think as Jerianne just said, the church is somewhat complicit, right, in the erasure of Black life in early America. What I will say, though, is, and this should not be surprising, is that although there may not be hints in the records, people left, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, they left signs, right? So I'm thinking about the big burial ground project in New York a couple of decades ago, where one of the things that was very clear is that in these segregated burial grounds, and that's one thing that we must remember, is that the majority of burial grounds were segregated. Segregation lived in death as it did in life. And so in these segregated burial grounds, when the bodies were exhumed, one of the things that was so very telling and so very powerful was that there were often buried with them mementos or important objects that connected them to Africa, right? So whether it was shells or some kind of a material object that managed to travel with them across the ocean to what would become their home, that these also become markers of not simply of Black life, but more specifically African life. And so it reminds us once again that we're talking about enslaved and free people in New England in particular, but we can't divorce them from their ancestors and from their past. And what's one of the things that historians absolutely live for is to be able to make these connections. And this is what Dr. Foreman spoke about before, making these direct connections. So while the records, yes, you have to be a very patient person to go through the documents, which oftentimes don't have the information, especially, and I'll mention, when we think about women whose last names change or the enslaved who typically were not given a surname, it makes it all the more difficult to track and trace them. And sometimes our trails run cold until we get to burial sites. So for me, these burial site projects, whether they're in New Hampshire or Maryland or Pennsylvania, these are so important, not only for the purpose of local history, and I think that's wildly important, but once again, I'll argue that this is a corrective. This is an intervention in the way we write and think about the nation's history.
Well, here's an email from Lori in Lyme that just came in. And Gabrielle, throw this to you, please. She says, thank you for hosting a show on this topic. Your guests have talked about memorials for African Americans who became famous or gained freedom. Do they have suggestions for a respectful way to acknowledge the sites of graves of enslaved persons? And Lori, thank you for writing. Gabrielle, what do you think?
That's such an important question. Thank you for it. Because what we think of as famous really is dependent on the work we all do in this present moment to resurrect lost and buried lives. So Harriet Wilson was a woman in bondage in New Hampshire, not enslaved, but in bondage, treated as a slave. And it's really the work of scholars and community organizers like the Harriet Wilson Project, which have made her prominent and important today. Ona Judge was not someone whose life was celebrated, whose details of her life were relatively unknown until Dr. Armstrong Dunbar spent years and years going through the pain, staking process of resurrecting the life of this unknown, courageous, brave woman who freed herself but remained a fugitive and had to run various times as a free person to evade the efforts of the most powerful man in the United States, George Washington, and his slaveholding wife, Martha. So I think that question gets at both the impulse to make sure that we preserve the lives of the most depreciated people in our society, and also speaks to what happens when we do attend to those lives, some of whom did amazing things, lives were amazing because they survived.
Running away from George Washington and staying hidden for the rest of your life is a pretty amazing feat. We have to wrap it up there, but wow, I want to thank all of you very much for being with us. We've been talking with Gerrion Bogus, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, and Gabrielle Forman. And today's show was produced by Exchange producer Christina Phillips. Thanks for being with us, everybody. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.